The year was 1934. It was the end of the Great Depression. A brand new Dodge cost around $600. Gas was just 18 cents a gallon. And an ice cream cone ran you a nickel. It was the Big Band era. Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, and Count Basie. It was a time of comic book heroes. Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, and Dick Tracy. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were two 19-year-old kids from Cleveland, Ohio, a Midwestern industrial city. Siegel aspired to be a hotshot reporter, but nobody really wanted to give him a chance. Now, almost a half century later, he recalls the night he came up with what he thought was quite a novel idea.
In 1934, one night, as I lay there, ideas kept coming to me. I thought of different things which had happened to me in real life, how frustrated I was and how spectacularly unsuccessful I was with the ladies and all that. And I had wanted to be a reporter. All these elements came together into Man from Another Planet, who worked as a mild-mannered reporter, Clark Kent, for a newspaper, and was scorned by Lois Lane, the girl reporter. Well, more and more ideas kept coming to me, and I dashed right over at Joe's house. He lived about 12 blocks away.
Joe, of course, is Joe Shuster. At that time, a budding young artist and the other half of the team that created the modern-day monument to the forces of good in this world.
Well, I was inspired just as much as Jerry. I was so enthusiastic about it, I sat down on my drawing board. We didn't stop for breakfast. We worked all morning, all afternoon, started conceiving the whole thing. And that one afternoon, we had the entire concept.
Out of this concept was born the legend that was to become the greatest comic book superhero of all time. Hero of millions, fighter of evil, the one, the only, the original super-powered superhero who has captured our hearts and our imaginations for nearly 50 years.
The Adventures of Superman. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Superman.
The History of Superman, a very special. Tracing the legend of the Man of Steel from his comic book beginnings through his development in the media of radio and television, right up to his current multi-million dollar celluloid status. The History of Superman, starring the same incredible cast that breathed life into what were once just two-dimensional characters, turning them into flesh and blood for moviegoers around the world to cheer. Actors like Christopher Reeve as the Man of Steel himself.
People are looking at their dreams when they look at Superman.
Margot Kidder as the unstoppable Lois Lane.
Lois has two completely different sides.
Criminal mastermind Lex Luthor, played by Gene Hackman.
As an actor, that kind of thing is always great fun.
Lex Luthor's lovely but dizzy girlfriend, played by Valerie Perrine.
It was great fun.
The unbelievably wicked General Zod, made all too real by actor Terrence Stamp.
Those wicked kids are going to love me.
And many more. The year was 1939. Germany invaded Poland on September 1st. World War II had begun. In Europe, the attention focused on Churchill and Hitler, while in America, the limelight was on Mickey Rooney, the number one box office star of the year. December 15th saw the long-awaited release of the epic Gone with the Wind. A real-life legend had his first starring role in a movie, John Wayne in Stagecoach. But on June 12th, several years after the inception of the character, Superman appeared in print for the first time. A legend had begun. The manner in which the comic strip took off seemed like a wayward dream to creators Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Even the names of their prime characters were based on their own personal big screen heroes.
Clark came from Clark Gable, and Kent came from Kent Taylor. Both were popular stars at that time. Lois Lane, the Lane sisters were very popular in movies at that time, and I liked the name Lola Lane, and I made a play on that, Lois Lane, and which I thought would be fine to call a girl reporter.
Look! Up in the sky! It's a bird! It's a plane! Now, it's
Siegel and Shuster had no idea that their concept would grab hold of a nation and never let go. America was ripe for a superhero who could ride us out of the Great Depression in grand style and provide a full share of romance, adventure, and excitement as well. And Superman, as created by the two kids from Cleveland back in the 1930s, definitely filled the bill. So how did Superman become a leading man in the world of comic book fans?
The Superman story was used...
Saul Harrison, recently retired, longtime president of DC Comics. Superman's home on the printed page.
At first, it went slowly, getting Siegel and Shuster to write and draw more chapters to the original story that was created. And then it just grew like Topsy. More and more work had to be done. The character got calls for putting him on the radio. It became big after the first few months.
I remember the first copy of Superman coming out, and I just loved it. 1938, when I was 7 years old.
From Major Nelson in I Dream of Jeannie to the outwitted Army commander in Superman the movie to the wicked J.R. in the hit TV series Dallas, Larry Hagman recalls his first real-life encounter with Superman.
So I remember when it came out, and it was just marvelous, this omnipotent being, you know, that could do all the things for good and all the evil people were vanquished. And yeah, I suppose it was a symbol of my life. That was when America was the good guy. You know, we weren't in any bad wars. When we all Americans wore white hats and rode on white horses and carried white guns, and, you know. Now it's not quite the same. A bit tarnished, isn't it?
The year 1940 saw Superman leap out of the pages of the comics and onto the airwaves. That's when, recalls Sal Harrison, DC Comics got into the radio business, courtesy of their first genuine superstar, Superman.
Originally, in the radio series, DC actually hired their own production people. A team of well-known people in the field were put together. The line of the character, you still listen to those tapes today, are as good today as they ever were then.
The radio series attempted to flesh out the characters in Superman with just the right voices. So, three times a week, Bud Collier played the Man of Steel on the radio. Although if he seems slightly more intimidating than the Superman you're used to, just keep reminding yourself this is vintage material.
Jack, look. What's that up ahead in the middle of the road?
I don't know. It's a man, isn't it?
I think so, but well, what's he doing on the road? Jack, look out!
Good thing he got out of the way. We'd have smeared him all over the road.
Gee, I thought sure you were going to hit him. Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, it looked like a red cape.
That's what I thought.
Hey! What's happening?
We're slowing down.
No, it can't be.
We're stopping.
But it's crazy. The motor's racing.
It won't be for long. Pardon me while I reach in and turn the ignition key.
What?
Here we are.
Hey! What's the big idea? Who are you?
Get out of the car, both of you.
No, wait a minute.
I'm not in the habit of waiting. Get out. Come on, make it fast. All right, I'll help you out.
Just move. You're breaking my arm.
It's only a sample. Come on, Miss Roebling.
I'm coming.
That's better.
Jack, it's the fellow with a cape. The one who was on the road.
No, we're seeing things. It can't be.
You're not seeing things. Not quite certain what your game is, but I can imagine it isn't on the level.
Jack, here's the gun.
Put your hands up or I'll shoot.
You think that little pearl-handled toy frightens me?
Get your hands up or I'll let you have it. Stand back, I said.
Too bad you couldn't see those bullets bounce off my chest. It's a pretty sight.
Jack! Jack! He's still standing.
Well, six shots. That means the gun's empty.
From the golden age of radio to the very first appearance of Superman on the silver screen in 1948 was quite a spectacular step, even for the Man of Steel. Kirk Allen says he also remembers it being an embarrassing step.
I was the first human being to have nerve enough to put on the tights and go out there and make a fool of himself. That's how I felt when I first did it.
Kirk Allen was our very first real live cape and tight Superman. And he says from Superman on the airwaves to Superman in three dimensions meant a lot of alterations.
When I did Superman, I heard the radio show years before, for many years. And hearing the radio show, they had cliches and they had standard lines like up, up and away and this looks like a job for Superman and all that. Well, you do that because you can't see what he's doing. You see, you have to imagine what he's doing. And he's got to tell you that he's going to change into a Superman clothes and go off and fight whatever the evil he has to fight. And he has to tell you all these things. Now, when you're watching the fellow on a screen, it's a little ridiculous to say up, up, and away, or this looks like a job for Superman, because you do it all with your looks. People know by looking at your face what you're going to do.
One thing people didn't know Superman would do, however, would be to appear in their very own living room. Courtesy of a magic glowing box known as television. Coming up, Superman leaps from the small screen to the big screen in a single bound. The year was 1953. Richard Milhouse Nixon was vice president of the U.S. The Korean War became just another battle-filled memory. The big names of the day were Dwight Eisenhower, Joseph McCarthy, General Douglas MacArthur, Dr. Martin Luther King, James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, Willie Mays, and Davy Crockett. It was the birth of rock and roll. And a musical legend was in the making. Elvis Presley. At the same time, a daring little show that combined the elements of fantasy, fun, and familiarity began a 28-year unbeaten run.
The Adventures of Superman.
A new television legend.
My agent and the man that was casting it said, look, said, nobody will ever see this show. It's a summer's work, and why don't you just take the money and run? And so I did it. I took the money and I ran. I did go to New York. And it came on the air in 1953. We shot it in 51. At that time, there was no film television. And we did these 39 shows, I guess it was. And they went on the air in 53. And, of course, then there you were. A national monument.
If Jack Larson's voice sounded familiar, it's probably because he is better known as Clark Kent's overeager co-worker on the Daily Planet. How could anyone ever forget that good-natured cub reporter Jimmy Olsen, with his short hair and his readiness for whatever trouble Lois Lane was about to get him mixed up in? Jimmy, whose most famous line was without a doubt,
"Golly, Superman, I never thought you'd get here,"
was just one member of the Superman TV family, which DC Comics established back in the early 50s. Former D.C. President Saul Harrison remembers.
We started to do the first stories for TV. We did 105 chapters. We created the production company again. And luckily, I think, got a George Reeves to work in the series, who really became the figure of Superman in the three dimensions.
Oh, the thing I always associate with Superman is, of course, George. He was a completely different kind of person than he was as Superman, and he had a long cigarette holder. And I always, and off camera, George would always be standing there in his cape with his long cigarette holder and his cigarette, which used to make me laugh. I think it was one of the reasons that Jimmy smiled so much, because I just see George there. He'd be doing the reverse lines to me with his long cigarette holder. And as he stood there, and sometimes he'd pick up his cape in front of him, and he was a camp, and I think of it in terms of George, of course.
George Reeves made Superman so real, so convincing, that America had no trouble believing in the Man of Steel and all the astounding feats he pulled off in the television series. Jack Larson, who got his first-hand view of Reeves as Superman while in character as sidekick Jimmy Olsen, remembers.
He played it seriously. Sure, there's wrinkles in the uniform, and George steadily got into tighter corsets, I think. And it wasn't easy. It was a hard part. I had to do a lot of stunts, and did a lot of stunts, and I loved doing my own stunts. Crazy kid that I was, they couldn't get me to do them. Were I acting today, I wouldn't do them. But George was really athletic. He could go out those windows on a diving board. If they were smart enough to cut quickly, they cut before his feet and legs buckled up, and he went under. Sure, he made a convincing Superman.
While George Reeves had no problem at all convincing his television audiences back in the 50s that he was indeed the real Superman, some critics, even today, can't figure out Reeves and Superman's appeal. Noelle Neal, who played Lois Lane on the TV show, says it's really no mystery to her.
As somebody in Chicago wrote a very critical review when the show went back on one of the channels and saved their ratings, He said, I can never understand why people watch this show. He said, you have a managing editor, an owner of the newspaper, Perry White, who has three totally incompetent people working for him. And no press room, no people in the hallways because we couldn't afford extras. So he said, I never could figure how the Daily Planet got off the ground or got published. Now, it's really quite true. We were really just always flying off somewhere and getting into some, you know, miserable situations and never showing up. And poor Perry, where is everybody? But maybe that's what made people relate to us, I guess. The bumblers and all of us. Somehow we lucked through in the half an hour.
But Superman and his family of friends, admirers, and adversaries were destined for greater glory than a half-hour series of low-budget black-and-white television. 21 years after TV watchers first adjusted their horizontal hole to see George Reeves in cape and tights with a big red S on his chest, a new incarnation of the superest superhero of all was in the making.
Superman was born and came into my life like a fire. Shooting through the sky, flying through the moon, going higher.
The year was 1974. Richard Nixon resigned as President of the United States. The Vietnam War officially ended. The Beatles had come and gone. Man had already left his footprints on the moon. Producers Alexander and Elias Salkind were fresh off their successful film The Three Musketeers, searching high and low for a suitable follow-up project. As they sat in a Paris cafe, Elias Salkind recalled how Superman swooped down on them, as if from the Eiffel Tower.
I was having dinner with my father in Paris at the Café de la Paix, and we were desperately looking for a good idea after The Musketeers. It was a pretty big success. So I said, why don't we do Superman? I got very excited. But I also said, you see, the point in Superman is if we do Superman now, it's really something that everybody will look up to because everybody is in need for a hero and is in need for a bigger-than-life character representing good. I mean, that's corny, but that's what it is.
From corny to classic was one big step for Superman, but a giant leap for Salkind. And so the search for the star of this incredible epic began. The Superman hunt was on. Right from the start, it took on all the major proportions of the nationwide talent search years before to fill the role of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. Vivian Leigh eventually won the coveted role of Scarlett. However, for the part of the Man of Steel, no one seemed to have the edge. Robert Redford declined. Even a Beverly Hills dentist was auditioned. But in 1976, the question on everybody's lips was, Christopher who?
My first reaction when they said they put you up for Superman, I couldn't believe it. I thought I had the wrong number completely. And I thought no more about it until the phone rang again in January and they said they want you in London tomorrow to screen test. And I said, oh, no, come on, you're kidding. I can't go to London. We're telling these people enough already. This is ridiculous. There's so many people all over the place. Go to the Y, pick up somebody with some muscle. I mean, let's, you know, really, all these people, they're gonna kick me. If I get Superman, all the heavy people are going to come and beat me up. He said, well, listen, we want you in London tomorrow. I said, I can't. I'm in a play. And my understudy wasn't ready. So anyway, we finally worked everything around, and I thought there's absolutely nothing to lose. Except I was still apprehensive because I didn't know how they're going to do it. How are they going to make this thing happen? And I'll tell you, when the transition point was for me was when I went over to DC Comics and I met Saul Harrison, who was the sort of publisher, and I was really surprised by his intelligence and his perception of the character. He gave me the script and I took it home and I read it once, and then I set it down and I read it through again, cover to cover, 500 pages, you know, of script. Then there were some scenes which missed by a mile, some scenes which were funny in the wrong way. There was a scene, for example, in which Superman's flying around the Metropolis and he's looking for Lex Luthor, you know, who's completely bald. And he sees this bald man in the street come swooping down on top of them, and it's Telly Savalas who turns around and says, who loves you, baby, and gives him a lollipop. Now, from my way of thinking, that's funny in the wrong way. You know, that's camp humor instead of legitimate humor. So there were scenes like that which sort of had to go, you know. But in the midst of all that, was a really terrific story about a man who comes from someplace else, doesn't know who he is, and finds out about it and becomes a leader. And it wasn't corny and mock heroic, and the scenes for Clark Kent were really endearing and funny. And I said, this is getting good. This is really getting terrific. And by the second time I'd read that script, I really wanted to do it.
Just a moment. There's more to Superman than Clark Kent minus the glasses.